There are builders, the boomers, Gen X, millennials and Gen Z. But what about the youngest kids today, the ones coming in the next few years as well? Our guest is Mark McCrindle, a social researcher who helped create their moniker, Generation Alpha. It covers children born between 2010 and 2024, and when Gen Alpha is done, there'll be almost 2 billion of them around the globe, making them the largest generation in history. So what do we know about them? The lives they're leading already and what their futures look like. Mark has co-authored a book called Generation Alpha, Understanding Our Children and Helping Them Thrive. He is with us now from Sydney. Hi, Mark. Thanks very much for your time.
Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
I'm just trying to find the page here where you list in Generation Alpha's lifetime so far the words of the year. 2011 was app, 2012 cloud, 2013 hashtag, 2014 selfie. You catching my gist? 2015 face with tears of joy, which isn't even a word. 2016 post-truth, 2017 fake news, 2018 toxic, 2019 climate emergency, 2020 COVID-19 lockdowns, social distancing, Black Lives Matter, cancel culture, super spreader. What a time they're being born into. And where did you even begin your research? Where do you even begin to approach a whole generation's experience?
Well, firstly, we knew we needed to, because understanding each new generation does give us a lens to the future. It helps us make sure our education, our employment, our structures, our community engagement is set up well for each new cohort, because we can't just think that each new generation is going to adapt to what has gone on before. In fact, we find that people resemble their times even more than they resemble their parents. And so adjusting and adapting is important to remain relevant. So we started, because they are so young, by looking at all of the generations and understanding the context into which they're being born, and also the parenting styles that are shaping them. And then we conducted lots of surveys and interviews with these young people themselves. So it's a series of a lot of research that brought us to the outcome of this book.
I wonder if it's worth just touching on some of those earlier generations. We know roughly what we're talking about in terms of era, and we certainly know how we characterise them. But when you're coming at this from what state the world was in, and also how that affected parenting, can you compare and contrast, as you do a bit at the start of the book?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. You know, most of us, if we're Generation X or Y, or even some of the oldest Gen Zs, were shaped in and born in the 20th century. And so we have more of a structured thinking. We have a linear approach to things. Life was a bit more, if you like, ordered and sequential. These days, we've got a generation that are carrying the technology in their pocket, and they're a few clicks away from any information on the planet. And life is not as structured. It's the glass, it's the visual that they interact on, those devices. In fact, as we said in the book, the year that they were born, 2010, that they began being born, that was the year that Instagram was launched and the iPad came around. So they've only ever known these digital times and the visual nature of the communication, the social influence, the global connection, the mobile nature of life and where they'll study and work. That they have been key factors shaping them. And so it does mean that what we experienced in the past is different to what they are being shaped in. Like we said in the book that, hey, we're all sharing these new technologies. We've all lived through this COVID-19 era, but we haven't all lived through it at a young age in our formative years. And the age at which we're exposed to a global event or a new technology or a new social norm, that determines how embedded it will become in our lifestyle and psyche. So that's why they're so different to those of us that went before.
You've described them as up ages. What do you mean by that?
That they're older, younger. So we are talking about those that are under 12, but in some ways they're sort of like the teenagers of a generation ago. They've got access to more information than ever. They're connected with their peers more. A lot of the teachers said to us in the research that the things I was doing with those that were 6 or 7 a few years ago, we're now doing with those that are just starting school. You know, those that the education that used to take place in years 5 and 6, we're now doing year 3 and 4. So there's this sense that that they're older, younger, and that they, in a sense, are cramming in a bit more life. Maybe the childhood years are ending earlier as they move into the tween years, which sort of are like the teen years of the past. So everything seems to be accelerating in their world.
However, you suspect they will stay in adolescence for longer, and we know, depending on how you calculate it, that can be well into your 20s, particularly for boys, just with brain development stuff. But when you bring the brain development stuff and put it together with their environment, why do you think they will stay in what we might call adolescence for longer?
Well, that's a really interesting point. As I said, adolescence is beginning earlier as they up-age, but extending longer as they stay in the parental home and in on the educational conveyor belt. Mainly the reason for that extended adolescence, the reason that the 20-somethings are not the time that the parents had of marriage, mortgage, children, career. Now the 20-somethings are this extended adolescence time. One of the key factors is the cost of living. It's housing affordability. It's the increase in formal education, so you know more of them going off to university than ever before, and it does mean, therefore, that the markers of adulthood and independence have been delayed. In fact, we in the book we said that they will be called the Kippers generation, K-I-P-P-E-R-S. That stands for Kids in Parents' Pockets Eroding Retirement Savings, i.e., they'll stay well into their 20s as a norm with their parents.
Let's look, it's impossible to separate them from technology in some ways, but we must, because they're not robots, but they are obviously, as we all are, going to experience more and more of life through a digital experience, and they are born in the thick of it. So I do want to get to the technology, but there's a neat graphic on page 36 of the book which shows some of the toys and music associated with each generation. What can we learn from that graph?
Well, just how technology really has entered into their free time and their space. So, you know, we talked about of previous generations, roller skates and frisbees. Maybe for us Gen Xers, it was Rubik's Cubes and BMX bikes. The Gen Zs had scooters and the start of technology. But for this generation of alphas, we have found that 75% of their time outside of school is spent on screens. It's like we've entered a global experiment putting screens in front of children from the youngest age and for this extended period of time and in their formative years. So it's quite profound, the impact. I think there are some benefits around learning, around the ability to interact and connect maybe with grandparents who aren't where they are, maybe to learn from others in other parts of the world. But there's certainly some downsides to this extended screen experience. And it means that they're not getting out as much into the outside world. We talk about nature deficit disorder in the book, where they just don't feel comfortable outdoors, climbing a tree or in the bush. They're less likely to have that unstructured free play where they have to be creative and make up their own games because of the hyper-stimulation of the screen. So certainly some downsides to this technology generation. As well as the benefits of the technology that they have.
Screen generation, you call them, in fact. Interestingly, Gen A is one of their top toys or music trends is the fidget spinner. The other's a smart speaker and streaming. But the fidget spinner interests me because we perceive, even in their older generation, the generation before them, high levels of anxiety, but there's also that always on, always incoming stimulus. Now, again, you can get into moral panic over this. You can see kids actually navigating this incredibly well, in fact, possibly better than their parents in some ways. But there is no doubt that wired into the brains now, because of the amount of exposure, is a very high level of always-on stimulus. Now, what are they showing signs of doing well with there, and what are the downsides we need to watch for as their parents and supporters?
Great question. Well, the ability for them to consume a lot of content is pretty incredible. In fact, they're not just watching one screen, they're multi-screening. A lot of them now, as they start to listen to audiobooks or podcasts, will listen at 1.5 speed just because they can cram a lot more information in a shorter period of time that way. And they do have the ability to if you like, not just consume content, but create it and participate in those conversations and add to the memes or to the TikTok, to the viral trends. So they're not just passive consumers of content, but they're contributors to it. It does have a social benefit as well. They might be playing Fortnite or interacting on some of these games, but they're interacting with other people, not just bots, and communicating as they do. So there can be some benefits to it. But it is impacting on attention span. It is harder for them to get to sit and to focus on a written work, to do that deep and reflective thinking, to sometimes do critical thinking rather than just consuming the first piece of information that they come across. You know, we're going to need to equip them for a world, certainly, where they have digital skills and they're well geared up for that, a world of AI and automation and robotics. So they'll be really well equipped for this technological future. But they're also going to need to develop those timeless human skills, the social interaction, the people skills, the life skills, just the ability to adapt, to be resilient, to have that character formation, to be entrepreneurial in a world of change. So they need both the old school timeless human skills as well as these new ones, and getting the balance in that is going to be critical.
You look into that in quite some detail in the chapter, Educating Generation Alpha. How well are schools, we'll talk about parents in a moment, but how well are schools both managing what they're getting with this new generation of children, but also adapting to optimise what they need, not just the way they learn and where they've come from, but what they're going to need? Is the education system keeping up in a sound adaptation?
It is. I mean, educators are very adaptive because this is their craft. They deal with each new generation as they come through, and I'm pleased to see how adaptive education has been. I mean, we see the technology that they use. We see the change to the curricula to accommodate this new generation. But there's more to be done. And I think in broader terms, we need to think about what we're trying to achieve with education. Because if all we're doing is delivering to students a body of knowledge, content, well, that's a challenge because their future is multi-career, it's multi-job, it's multi-sector. In fact, many of them won't just be looking for a job, they'll be creating their own jobs. It's a gig economy type future. It's an entrepreneurial future. They'll be creating their own employment outcomes. They'll be multi-career, and we estimate they'll work across six separate careers in their lifetime and many more jobs than that. So what we need to equip them with is not just learning, but learning how to learn, to be lifelong learners, to plug in and upskill and retrain, to be adaptive, to do what computers can't do, which is to make decisions amid complexity, to be creative, to interact well with people, and to have empathy and to connect. So it's some of those broader competencies that education needs to deliver, not just the three R's that we used to know. And this is key. I mean, if we think about New Zealand, there are already 600,000 of these Gen Alphas. So they're not just an emerging generation. They're fast becoming a very large one. There'll be a million of them when they're all born. And of course, for the next decade, they'll be the key generation in the primary school system.
Can we talk about parenting and what your research revealed about how Gen A, so children born since 2010, is being parented? Is there much of a change from previous generation?
Well, there is. And parents are very intentional now in working out how to raise their children. You know, these parents of the Gen Alphas are the millennials, the Generation Ys, and they're like saying, wow, it's a different upbringing to when I was at school because we didn't have the mental health issues that we're seeing today, the anxiety levels. Our childhood was a bit more carefree than what we're seeing. We didn't feel the competitiveness around getting the right end of school results so that we could get into the right university courses, the global competition, the economic uncertainty, let alone a pandemic on top of that. So parents in response to this are saying, well, we need to maybe look up some parenting blogs. We can't just sort of roll along with this. And as for their economic future and being able to afford a home or work in a job, and bearing in mind that the jobs market is changing so much, how do we raise them? And I think that parents can trust their intuition a bit. You know, we don't have to be digital experts to raise this generation in this great screen age because they will adapt and get that pretty well. In fact, what we need to do is in some ways take a leaf from the book of our parents or grandparents and ensure that we are developing them in an environment where they're encouraged, supported, and know there's great love and affection. At the same time as we are clear on what those boundaries and expectations are so that we can develop their character and ensure that they are well equipped for the future from a, I guess you would say, a character and a values formation perspective. And if they have both the love, support and acceptance, as well as the boundaries, and we're stretching them and we're developing their formation, that's going to set them up well. We say in the book, you know, put them to bed the way that our grandparents did, which is leaving the screens to the side and reading a book or telling a story. We say that if we can delay access to their own device just that little bit longer, maybe they can use our smartphone from time to time if they want to have some fun on the screens, but not have their own, then we can bring that 75% time, discretionary time spent on screens, down to 30 or 40%, and they can develop some of those broader life skills, sporting and activity, to develop those fine motor skills and the coordination skills and just a competence in life rather than just a digital competence. So there's some of the tips that we give parents in the book.
What of the impact of COVID-19 and the pandemic? As you said, when you experience something and you've been through a few life experiences, you know there's light at the end of the tunnel, hopefully. Yes. You know that bad times come and they're replaced by better times. When it happens when you're young, as you say, it tends to really imprint because it's your first experience. What's been their experience, do you think, of this pandemic?
Well, it has created some challenges for them. I mean, they had to do some learning from home. They many of those social events were disrupted. You know, you only get one, you know, graduation from primary school or one go at year four or year five. Those that went through their final exams and some of them missed out on end of year formals and many have missed out on the overseas experience, which has been so formative for many generations of young people in New Zealand and beyond. You know, there was a grieving and there has been a sense of loss. And of course, when you're 7 or 8 and you've had maybe 4 or 5 years of memory of life, 1 year is 20% of your whole experience. So its impact on them are far more profound. But I do see some positives coming from it. You know, they've seen their parents work from home and the adaptation of that. They've been able to do some learning from home and the flexibility in learning where it doesn't just have to take place at an environment, that we can decouple learning from location is a fantastic outcome for a digital future. And indeed, when you go through tough times in your formative years, it tends to create a sense that stability matters and that you've got to have savings for a rainy day, that the economy doesn't always go up. Sometimes it goes down. That, if you like, in life, we have our winters, not just our summers. And that can create, like it did in the generations that went through the Great Depression or the wars, a sense of values and hard work and a work ethic that has sustained those prior generations very well. Because we do learn more in the tough times than we do in the good times. And I think that is a silver lining in this COVID cloud, that I think it'll create a great sense of character in this generation of young people.
Just finally, Mark, you define them as digital, social, global, mobile, visual. That all makes sense. The visual's a big one, though, isn't it? And I think YouTube is the number one place they go to. They don't even, ahead of Google, actually. Why Google it when you can see it? However, that needs parents to be on alert, doesn't it? When we know how the algorithms work on YouTube in particular, that, and combining this with, you know, them being the screen generation, you need to be on your alert as to what they are seeing and how they are being guided by those algorithms, because unfortunately that's what happens.
Exactly right. And some of the parents were saying to us, we're not sure whether the internet and the screens are the greatest blessing or the greatest curse for our children, because they do see the downsides. I mean, incredible opportunity to connect and to be aware of the broader world and to have friendships even in lockdowns and to be able to, you know, develop some of the social interactions. But at the same time, they access sometimes some negative things. They are, as you said, being pushed messages which may not be true or of solid source, you know, fake news and all of that. They can end up comparing their lives to the lives of others. They can feel inadequate sometimes, and it can create a sense of of disappointment. Oh, look at this person's life, look at their success, and here I am, you know, struggling away. And it can create a fake world, of course. And maybe sometimes even the views that we get exposed to through those algorithms just really reflect our own. And rather than opening up our eyes and our minds, it ends up creating an echo chamber. So there's some of the downsides that parents are aware of. We found in the research that much of the bullying and put down that they experience is now not in the playground or in the school, but it's in the virtual.
Yeah,
it's through the
sure.
devices. And, of course, you can't escape that. So parents have to be wary, have to take control of those devices, have to create a safe environment and make sure they're aware of what the children are accessing and really guide them through that so that they can access the best of the digital but avoid the negatives.
Thank you, Mark McCrindle, who with Ashley Fowle and Sam Bucklefield has penned Generation Alpha. They come up with the term, actually, Gen A, the babies born from 2010 through to 2024. Understanding our children and helping them thrive is the book.